Well, I call your attention this evening to James chapter 5. James chapter 5. We're down to three or four messages, and then we'll be done with the book. Well, tonight, the title of the message this evening is Perhaps Today. Perhaps Today. Last week, we started in verse 1 and we got through verse 6. And so tonight, we're going to pick up in verse 7. When I was preaching last Wednesday evening, I mentioned to you that the dominant group that he was writing to had been given a reprieve or given a little break. If you look back at the contrast between the way he begins verse 7 and the way he began verse 1, you'll notice the distinction. In verse 7, he says, "Be patient, therefore, brethren." If you look back at verse number 1, he says, "Go to now," or "Come on now, you rich men." In other words, he's dealing with really some people that were unsaved, that were just in Judaism, but they were cheating people, they were not paying people, they were not keeping their word, they were doing everything they could to wheel and deal and cheat, taking things that didn't belong to them. And so he basically talked about how that they basically are going to get judged. But now in verse number 7, where we're at this evening, I want you to see that he's back to our normal group that we started this whole study with. It was those brethren that were scattered abroad. Look with me at verse 1, and maybe if you've got a pen in your hand, I want you to maybe underline the word brethren. Then I want you to look down at verse 9, and there's another word, brethren. If you look at verse 10, you'll see brethren. And if you look at verse 12, he says, "My brethren." And so, in 7 through 12, which is our passage for tonight, you'll notice that he uses the word brethren at least four times. And so there's no doubt about who he's preaching to this evening. Well, not only that, I want you to also look at another phrase, and he reiterates this, and so this is why I titled the message tonight, Perhaps Today. Look with me at verse 7. He says, "Unto the coming of the Lord." So in other words, the Lord is coming back, and so I want you to do something because he's coming back. Then look with me at verse 8. "For the coming of the Lord draweth nigh." And so, what do we have? We've got now two verses that talk about the coming of the Lord. Well, then, I want you to look with me at another word. I want you to look at the word patience. In verse 7, he says, "Be patient." In verse 7, he says, "Long patience." Verse 8, "Be ye also patient." At the end of verse 10, he says, "Long or suffering affliction and of patience." And so we see that patience in our five verses tonight is something that's very important. And then, just by way of explanation, look with me at the end of verse 7. It says, "The early and the latter rain." Well, somebody would say, what is that a reference to? Well, it's very simple, and when you look at it this way. The early rain are the rains that come beginning in November and in December. You see, they have winter rains, but then when the summer comes, the ground begins to get parched. It begins to dry out. There's cracks everywhere. The little brooks that are called wadis, they have dried up. because there's no rain in the summertime. And so the early rains are rains that come in early November through December. And that's when the ground begins to get really saturated. Those cracks and those crevices begin to have water that gets down into them. The fields that now have no grass, they're just parched and everything is dead. They begin to soften a little bit. And the farmers can even begin to plant to a certain degree in those months. But if it only had rain in November and December, that would not be enough to sustain the people because there'd be no food. And so what do they have? They have the latter rain. In other words, they began to do a lot of the preliminary stuff in December, late November. But then the latter rains come and it begins to give some additional rain, and that's usually sometime around March and April. One of the things that you will notice if you ever visit the country of Israel is that in the month of March, it's coming into the end of the rainy seasons. And it's not an uncommon thing for there to be rain almost on a daily basis, maybe for a couple of 3 hours at a time. Then they will get into certain weather patterns where they maybe 2 or 3 days where they would have water. One of the most beautiful sights in the whole world is a place called Caesarea Philippi. And it's a lot prettier in March than it is in November. I've been to it both times of the year. And in March, you have the mountain range, Mount Hermon, behind you. And you can just see how that the water just cascades down the side of the mountain. And then you can see cracks and crevices that you're actually walking on. And you see water coming out of those cracks where that from the tops of the mountain, the rain has just found its way down through it. And it begins to go into what is called the Banas River. And really what it is it's just a little small creek. That's what we'd call it in South Georgia. I mean, the 15-mile creek now next to my mom is even wider than this place is. But what it is that is really the beginning of the Jordan River. And so when he talks about the early and the latter rains, those are the months that he is referencing. And the reason I tell you this is because he's going to give us an example of what these people do and what we need to do. Right? So I want us to begin in verse number 7, and we'll go through probably verse 9. And the first example that I want you to see is the example of a farmer, right? That's the first picture that he gives us. In verse 7, he says, "Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold the husbandman." That's an old English word which means farmer, right? The farmer waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and he hath long patience for it until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draws nigh. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Several things that I want you to notice about this farmer. Do you know what farmers look forward to? They look forward to the harvest. They look forward to having fruit that has come in. I come from a family that has some farmers in it. I had an uncle that he's kind of halfway retired now. He's turned a bunch of this stuff over to his oldest boy. But he's been a farmer from the time he was probably in his 20s. When my grandfather, who was a farmer, when he passed away, my uncle was a mechanic in Jacksonville. And so he talked to my grandmother and said, "Mama, what about if me and Janice move back and I just start farming and maybe open up a mechanic shop down in Collins," which is a little small town that's got one caution light in it. And somebody goes, "Well, where is that at?" "Well, if you really want to know, it's close to Cobbtown." You say, where's that at? Well, that's close to the interstate. And by the way, it's not unknown by people in this church. Miss Edna Warren knows where it's at because she and her husband lived in a place called Stillmore, which is not far away. And Kevin Wilcox has got a brother that lives in Collins across from the post office. And so it's a little small place. And so my uncle moved from Jacksonville and began farming. Well, in those early years, they farmed a lot of things, one of them being tobacco. He doesn't do that anymore. Now he had always dealt with onions in the past 20 years and Vidalia onions. And many of you have received some of those bags that I've gone down there and gotten over the years. And he's done corn and he's done cotton and he's done soybeans and all of that. And so, you know, whenever he puts that stuff out in the field, you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't go out there the next morning and say, where are my onions at? He doesn't go out there and say, well, I wonder where that cotton's at. The reason is because a farmer has got to have patience. Now, on a smaller scale, many of you probably grow tomatoes. All right? Every year you may set out, you know, some tomatoes, and you've got visions of just tomato sandwiches on Sunday nights after church. And I mean, you're just looking forward to that. But do you know you don't plant those plants or you start it from a seed and the next day you go out and all of a sudden you've got a big old Park's Whopper tomato that you can just slice it and put it on a piece of bread and you got a big sandwich. No. No, you've got to wait sometimes close to 3 months before you get that first tomato, depending on what variety you've got. And all of those tags will lie to you. They'll say, these are the early ones. Oh, in 65 days, you'll get tomatoes. Don't believe that. They tell you that so that you'll buy it. It's going to take a good time to get a good tomato. And you're going to have to do some things to make that tomato. You know what a husbandman does? He doesn't just plant and say, all right, it ought to be here. Oh, no. He's fertilizing and he's making sure the weeds are pulled from around it. And he's got other stuff that he's got going. Maybe he's pulling the suckers off of those plants or whatever. But he is patient. Why? Because he's looking for that precious fruit that he's expecting. Well, James says, be patient about the coming of the Lord. And do you know one of the things that you and I have probably talked about in individual conversations about the Lord coming back? Wouldn't this be a day or a wonderful day for the Lord to come again? Yesterday when I was up at Gwinnett Medical and I was talking to Brother Holcomb, we talked about the coming of the Lord. I talk to Brother Don every week, and invariably the subject of the coming of the Lord is going to come up. When I visited Brother Roland the other day, he's been watching somebody on television when he's able to stay awake, and this guy's talking about the coming of the Lord, and Gary, who is now in hospice, he says, I believe I'm going to make it till the coming of the Lord. Brother Studer, he was, I think, in his 90s when he died. I mean, right up until the last, he believed he was going to make it until the coming of the Lord. And so James is telling these Christians, he says, you be patient. When I think of the word patient, I mean, it's somebody that's just able to just hang in there and not get anxious. Somebody that's able to just not get to the point to where they just go, I'm just cashing it in. I just don't believe it anymore. No, the picture is it's a farmer. And just like that farmer has got to be just easy and slow, he's going to just basically say, it's coming. And I'm going to suffer if I have to until then. I may not be able to get those green beans and I got to eat some frozen ones for a while. But hey, one of these days those fresh ones will be here. And that precious fruit is going to arrive. But I want you to notice something else. I want you to notice that when you're patient, it does something in verse 8. It establishes your heart. Well, that word establish, I've always kind of been under the impression that that's just the word that we use, establish. But it's really a little different than that. It has the idea of strengthening your heart. Do you know that when we are patient in the trials and in the sufferings that we have gone through, there's something about it that strengthens our heart? It gives us more strength. And why? Because we know that the Lord's coming. We know that the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Well, he closes out the picture of a farmer with verse number 9 when he says this, grudge not. And when I say, you know, the picture of a farmer and the grudge there, whenever we think about holding a grudge, that's not exactly the word that we would use if we were using the biblical word for grudge. This has the idea of don't murmur or don't groan against somebody that's your brother. He's not talking about somebody that is in the world. He's not talking about murmuring against them or groaning against them. He says, grudge not against one another. Do you know one of the things that God is going to make right? Because our passage tells us that he's the judge. One of the things that God is going to make right is that when brothers and sisters have things against one another that they have left unresolved at the judgment seat, Jesus is going to take care of that. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, that's a pretty sobering thought. I've known of people that have held grudges for decades. And I mean, it would be, I'll die before I will say that he or she's right and I'm wrong. But in their soul, they know that they're not right. But they want to just hold on and hold on and hold on. I'm going to tell you something. One of these days when the Lord comes, if there's an ought against a brother, Jesus is going to lay that bare and he's going to let everybody know that you were wrong. Or he's going to let everybody know that they were wrong and you were not willing to forgive. And so, just as that farmer is patient, and just as that farmer is waiting for that precious fruit, so he's saying, you look at a farmer and don't you murmur against another farmer. Now, what are farmers known for? Being good neighbors. Most of them are. If you're a farmer and your neighbor needs help, most of the time you'd probably go help him. Even if it meant leaving your crops or leaving your livestock, you would probably go try and be a good neighbor. The other day I was talking to my mom, and I was telling her about the demon dogs that we've got. And had another episode with them today. I literally got the 12-gauge out today. And they just about ruined my tie. I had to go through some briars to get one of them that, and we may need to pause this, that killed a chicken. And so I was talking to her and I said, I've just about got the electric fence completed. And she said, well, you got to be careful with that electric fence. Said, Wallace and Leon, which are her two baby brothers, whenever daddy was gone one day, the hogs kept getting out. And they knew where the hogs were getting out. They had rooted a wallow place and they would go under it and they'd get outside the fence. And so what they did was they filled it up with water and it had an electric fence. Well, they electrocuted and killed like 4 hogs. And she said, when daddy got home, he had to call the neighbors to come over and butcher hogs. He said, get out there and start building a fire, boys. We got to start boiling hogs, get hair off of them. And so they ended up having to process three or four hogs that my uncles had electrocuted. And so you know what those neighbors did? They came over and helped. And of course, my grandfather gave them, you know, some of the meat. And so farmers help farmers. Grudge not against one another. If we've got a brother or a sister that we've got an ought against, hey, don't murmur against them. Why? The Lord's coming and the Lord's the judge. Now, the unsaved people are going to be judged, but their judgment's 1,000 years after our judgment. And so the farmer is the first example. Verse number 10. I want you to look with me at the prophets. Take my brethren, in other words, look, my brethren, look at the prophets. Now, what prophets is he referencing? Old Testament prophets. Remember, James is one of the most Jewish books in the whole New Testament. He is Jewish through and through. You remember in the first chapter, to the brethren of the 12 tribes, they're Jewish people. And he says, take the prophets. Now, what did they do? Who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Now, the word patience in this verse means endurance. He says, you think about those Old Testament prophets. They spoke the word of the Lord, and when they did, they suffered affliction. They suffered persecution. They did it, and they endured it. You know, we have a tendency to think that, well, when you're a spokesman for God, everything is always good. And that's not exactly the case. I'll give you an example of some prophets. Most of you, and by the way, I'm thinking really seriously about starting this pretty soon. I may preach each Sunday through the minor prophets. Take one book per week and go for probably about 12 or 13 weeks and just preach on an overview of the minor prophets. You know, like Hosea, Joel, Obadiah, those guys. And that way you can have a working knowledge of when they preached and when they prophesied, who they preached to, because everybody didn't preach to the same group. You had some guys that preached down in Judah. You had other guys that preached up in Israel when the country divided. And so when I think about these prophets, not a lot of them really had a cushy life. What about Hosea? Hosea is a man of great, great sorrow. You say, well, why is he a man of great sorrow? Do you know what God told him to do? God said, Hosea, I want you to go and marry a woman that's a harlot. I mean, that's the way she made her living, was to sell herself. I want you to go and I want you to marry her. Okay. Well, he marries her, and he begins to fall in love with her. I mean, he cares about her, you know, and she does good for a while. And then the next thing you know, she runs off. And you know what God says? God says, go get her. He goes, and now she has basically been stripped naked. She's standing like on a slave block, and God says, buy her. And Hosea ends up buying Gomer. And he has to live with that. And here he is, he's a prophet of God. Well, what about some of these other guys? What about Amos? When I began preaching, the first sermon that I ever preached was out of Amos chapter 4, verse 12. Prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. I didn't know Amos in the Bible from Amos Moses that fought alligators. But I know that I'd been to the Baptist bookstore and got me a sermon book by a guy named Herschel Ford, and that was one of the the sermons in Herschel Ford's evangelistic sermon book, Prepare to Meet Thy God. There were 7 points in it. I preached 7 points in about 4 minutes. Those days are long gone. Old Amos, you know what? They liked him for a while until he began to prophesy against Jerusalem. Oh, and when that happened, the next thing you know, he goes south quick in the popularity contest. And I mean, he really gets put through the ringer. Well, what about Zechariah? You know, the one that did all the prophecies about how that all nations are going to gather together against Jerusalem to battle? You know what happened to him? They murdered him. What about Isaiah? You know, Isaiah, he was kind of a popular guy. He was in King Uzziah's royal court. I mean, he was really doing well. But King Uzziah died. And another guy came on the scene named Manasseh. You know how Isaiah died? They took him, they stuffed him in a hollow log and sawed him in half. What about Jeremiah? Jeremiah preached for about 40 years. He never had one convert. As a matter of fact, he was preaching about the Babylonians and how that they were going to come, and nobody wanted to hear it. And it got to the point to where they literally put him in a dry well to die. And he was just constantly weeping about the prophecies that God was giving him. And he tried to even not doing it. And it was as though God was saying, you got to do it. And it was like fire in his bones. He said, I had to say it. But those people didn't want to hear it. He's called the weeping prophet because nobody ever listened to the guy. And so you've got all of these different men. And I mean, they had godly lives. But they still suffered. And just because somebody is in the will of God doesn't mean that you're not going to suffer persecution and suffer trials and tribulations. The third picture that I want you to see tonight is found in verse number 11. Behold, we count them happy or blessed. Who do we count happy or blessed? Those people that endure. Those people that are just able to just keep on keeping on. And who does he give the example of? You've heard of the patience, the endurance of Job. Well, anybody ever heard of Job? You've heard that phrase. Man, that lady's got the patience of Job. And what they mean is they know about his story. They know that how he was one of the wealthiest men in the East. I mean, he had literally just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of various kinds of livestock. He had 10 kids that just seemed to love their mom and dad. They even loved each other. I mean, they're all together at a big party. I guess one of them's having a birthday party. But you see, Job doesn't understand what's happening behind the scenes. There's a conversation going on between God and the devil. And that conversation is something like this. God says, have you considered my servant Job? And the devil says, yeah, I've considered him. And the only reason that he serves you, the only reason he serves you is because you've blessed him. If you didn't bless him, he wouldn't serve you. He'd curse you. And God says, you think so? Yeah, I know so. God says, okay, I'll tell you what you can do. You can take away everything that he's got in his life except his life. And of course, now I'm paraphrasing, you know, you can read the story yourself in the first part of Job. And so what happens? Well, there's a whirlwind. Well, let me back up. There's some rustlers, and they come and they steal his livestock. Then there's a whirlwind or a tornado that comes along, flattens the house that all of his kids are having a party in, and all 10 of his kids and their families dead. Then God says, what about it? And he goes, well, if he didn't have his health, then he wouldn't serve you. And God says, okay, touch his body, but not his soul. The next thing you know, he's got sores and boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, and he's in constant agony. He sits in the ash pile with broken pottery and just scrapes. Why? He's trying to get some relief. And finally, his wife looks at him and says, why don't you just curse God and die? What a wonderful source of encouragement. And yet, he endures. I want you to go with me. Just hold your place here. I want you to go with me to the book of Job. Right before the book of Psalms is Job. And I want us to look at chapter 13 and verse 15. I think that's the one I'm wanting. Yes. In Job chapter 13, verse 15, he says, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. But I will maintain mine old ways before him. In other words, I will keep serving God. If he kills me, I'll serve God. It hasn't been 6 months ago when I was talking with the son of a man that is a member of this church. And he said, I want you to pray for my dad. He's bitter. And I said, can you tell me what he's bitter about? He said, yeah. He said, my mom got dementia. And my dad can't deal with it. And he's thinking that God is punishing him and her. And he said, if God's going to do that, I won't serve him. And he's quit church, and as far as I know, he hadn't been in church now in probably a couple of years. But it all started when his wife got dementia. Job said, if he kills me, I'll trust him. Well, when you think about that, I want you to flip over to chapter 42. Chapter 42 of Job. Let's look at verse 10. And the Lord reversed the fortune, if you would like to say it that way. The Lord reversed the fortune of the captivity of Job. All of that suffering, God turned it around. And what did he do? He got it turned around when he prayed for his friends. Isn't that a marvelous thing? He's making intercession for men that have been accusing him of having sin in his life. But yet he's praying for his friends. And then the next part of this verse says, also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. All of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of animals that he had, God gave him twice as much. And it'll give us an amount here in a few minutes. Then came unto him all his brethren. In other words, he had some brothers and sisters after the flesh. And his brothers and sisters had forsaken him. They didn't want to be around him. I mean, how are you going to look at your brother and go, man, look at that ugly boil. Look at that sore. We're not able to come eat dinner with you tonight. And they're talking together. I don't want him prepared no food for us. And he says, but now because he's better, he's healed. His brethren and his sisters, they all come. And then all of they that had been his acquaintances, all of his friends, they showed up to eat bread with him in his house. Well, if you look at the latter part of verse 11, this is, again, the culture, and probably in our culture it would fit today. Every man also gave him a piece of money. Some of them may have given him a piece of gold. Somebody may have given him a piece of silver. But they gave him a piece of money. And every one an earring of gold. So evidently the men had earrings. And they took it out and they said, here, whenever you go out styling and profiling, you can wear one of these. So he's got an earring that was given to him. Verse 12, so the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. He was one of the wealthiest men in the East in the beginning. And now God is just pouring it on more than he's ever dreamed possible. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, which means there were 2,000 oxen, and 1,000 she-asses or donkeys. And he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. I'm guessing that God got Mrs. Job back, pregnant 90 months. But this was something that just blessed my heart. The sons were mentioned first, but the daughters are mentioned by name. And it gives a description of the girls. He called the name of the first one Jemima. I guess that's where the pancake mix comes from. The name of the second, Keziah. And the name of the third, and I hope this is right, Karin Hapuch. If it's not right, you'll never know it. And in all the land of the East, were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. These were the best looking girls in the East. And what does it say about Job, what he did? Now, normally in those times, girls didn't get an inheritance. It all went to the boys or to the son-in-laws. But here, it says that their father gave them, those girls, inheritance among their brothers. In other words, just like the boys got something, the girls got something. And after this lived Job 140 years. After this, after God had blessed him, God gave him 140 good years to enjoy it. Well, not only did he enjoy it, but he got to see 4 generations of grandkids. I'm only seeing 1 right now, but it sure is fun. He got to see 4. And he died being old and full of days. Now go back quickly to James, and I want to share something very, very fast with you. You heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord. Now, I had to stew on that for a while because I'm thinking, is that a reference to the Lord at Calvary? And it's not. It carries the idea of this because the context is Job. So it has the idea of what we just read in chapter 42 of Job, his outcome. So if we were going to read it maybe today, we would say it like this, and have seen the end that God gave to Job. It's not the end of the Lord, it's the end of what God gave. The outcome is what we're looking at. And it says, and the Lord is very pitiful. Now, when we say, oh, God bless him, he's just pitiful, we mean that something in an ugly way where it's not really attractive. But here it has the idea of God is a gracious God. He is a compassionate God. He's taking pity upon people. The Lord is very, very compassionate. He's very, very gracious and of tender mercy. And then he closes by saying, above all things that you've just heard, brethren, swear not, neither by heaven nor by earth, neither by any other oath. In other words, don't go around making promises. Don't promise that you're going to do this or promise you're going to do that. Just live your life and you let your yea be yea let your nay be nay. In other words, if you tell a man something, you say, yes, I will do that, then you do your best to do it. If you say, no, I won't do that, don't change your mind and say, well, I will. Just know what's right to do, say yes to the things that are right, no to the things that are wrong, and don't go around making all of these oaths and all of these promises, you know, trying to, you know, make people think that, boy, he's really serious about this. You know, sometimes the more you talk, the less people really trust. The more you talk, the more it's like, he's selling me on this or trying to. And sometimes the more they talk, the less I'm sold. And so don't just go around making oath after oath after oath. Just simply say, my word's my bond. When my father-in-law was dying, they had moved up here so that Deb and I would have it easier taking care of them. And we had a fellow in the church that was in real estate at the time, and he helped get the contract on a house that they bought. And my father-in-law really, really liked him. And he said, you know, I want to take you and your wife out for a meal. I want to do that. And so the young man said, well, Mr. Fontaine, that'd be fine if that's what you want to do. My wife and I'd be honored to go. Well, he started getting sicker. And one day we were riding together. I'd taken him over to Snellville to get a treatment that he had to go on Tuesdays and Fridays. And I would take him one day and Deb would take him the other day. And we were talking, I don't remember if it was going or coming, but he had this promise on his mind that he said, I've got to take that boy out to get him and his wife a meal. And I said, Blue, it's okay. You don't have to do that. He understands that you've gotten sick. He said, no, Tommy, he said, I've got to do that. He said, a man that don't keep his word ain't no good. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know what? He's right. A man that don't keep his word, he just ain't got much character. One of the things that I have tried to do is I've tried never to lie to my kids. I tried not to make promises that I couldn't keep. Why? Because a man that don't keep his word can't be trusted. And so he said, you let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, okay? Hey, he may come tonight. And then all this trouble, all this suffering, all these trials, it'll be a thing of the past. Amen? Let's stand together.